Hooray! Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglund from the office. It's Irrational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core, in the middle of the Art Deco wonder, designed by Claude Biellman, no less. That is the Eastern Columbia. This is your Chillback Hollywood Hour, and I'm here with your co-host, as well as mine, Mr. Phil Lernest, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Dean Haglund.
You're welcome, Mr. Phil Lernest, ladies and gentlemen.
Mr. Lead Handgun, of course. Helen Spires.
Helen Spires. Ocho Cinco, noofity noof.
For those who don't know, the names Lead Handgun and Helen Spires are anagrams of the names Dean Haglund and Phil Lernest.
Lead Handgun.
As pointed out to us by Mr. Bob Pliskin.
Thank you, Bob.
Your friend in listening. sent some fantastic artwork to us over the many months, but including some artwork that will be on Chillback Hollywood Hour t-shirts.
What?
That I'm making up in time for the holidays.
What, you going to hand paint these things?
No, he sent the artwork.
Oh, he did, yeah.
No, and you're supposed to hook me up with the guys down here in the fashion district. The guys down in the alley that are going to make the t-shirts.
They're not in the alley. They're in the warehouse. Oh, well.
So hello to our listeners.
Hello, listeners.
Legion as you are, whether you're listening to us on Jackalope Radio.
Yes.
On the Talk Superstation.
Love them.
Downloading us, subscribing to us via iTunes or
easy.
Really simple syndication.
Yes.
And to all the fighting men and women. on the ships at sea. This is your Chillback Hollywood Hour.
What, hey, is it 1940?
Did you... we didn't talk about this last week
at all.
Did you watch the Comedy Central roast of Charlie Sheen?
I certainly did.
I thought you might.
I did, actually.
Your thoughts,
sir. My thoughts. I thought I was mildly amused. And
you thought you were mildly amused.
I thought I was mildly amused.
I'm going to have to disagree. You were not.
I was not.
I don't know.
There was a couple jokes that I thought were rock solid. You know, having just come from doing my dad's 80th birthday.
Exactly why I'm asking, sir.
I was appreciating solid jokes that were there and also seeing exactly when people were panicking, much like I thought Steve-O.
Well, now here's the thing. There were certain people who were roasting Mr. Sheen who are not comedians.
Yes.
Who are not, in fact, performers.
Right.
Mike Tyson.
Very good example.
Steve-O is not that kind of performer. Steve-O, one of the stars of the Jackass franchise.
And he broke his nose, by the way.
Yeah, at the end.
Yeah.
Doing a gag. Yeah, running into Mike Tyson.
Which is...
And then there were some stand-ups.
Yes.
However... I want you, if you could, because I've never actually participated in it. Well, I have. But,
yes.
But, you know, again, it's not a professional roast that I participated in.
Okay.
There's a certain skill set. It's not just go up and do stand-up comedy.
No.
There is a skill set specific to roasting, and my feelings were in watching this, and I'd watched other Comedy Central roasts, and indeed there were times when it was funny. This is a dying art form.
Yeah.
Clearly, or comedic form. I don't know if we want to call it an art form, but it's certainly a comedic form, and if there are people who have that skill set, they're not being called upon for these Comedy Central roasts necessarily. And certainly, of course, when I was a kid, I remember the Dean Martin celebrity roast.
Well, and that's the thing. Dean Martin celebrity roast started by the sheer fact that they all hung out in Vegas, when early 50s Vegas, they all were on stage at the same time, mocking each other, performing, and it was like a party you were invited to. So the celebrity roasts were an extension of that, where you have a bunch of guys that know each other really well, know each other's foibles, each other's sense of humors, and then you have that on camera, it's hilarious.
Am I wrong in saying that the other element that went into informing it and creating it was the tradition of the Friars Club? Because a lot of those performers on there were also...
Friar members.
You know, and comedians who were never part of necessarily the Rat Pack, but, you know, your Jonathan Winters and your...
Milton Berle and all those
guys,
these
comedians that also knew what they were doing.
Well, yeah,
but
because...
the writers of those shows clearly... knew it as well, because no matter who you had on as the non-comedic, non-performer guest, because that's part of the tradition as well.
Right.
Senator Barry Goldwater, so funny in the roast of Johnny Carson. In fact, maybe the funniest.
Right. Very funny. Reagan did a funny one, too.
Because the writers really not only knew how to write for that person's voice, which is an incredible
skill set,
but they also understood. And so... So what is it? What are some of the skills that maybe are lacking now?
Well,
to make a roast work, because you just hosted a roast and you had the experience that no one really knew what to do.
Yes. Well, Seth MacFarlane, I think, is actually pretty good as a host, because he's articulate, takes his time, moves the show on, and yet has no problem. He can deliver a punchline, a setup and a punchline, which a lot of comedians don't do anymore. You know, there's that here's a joke. As John Lovitz did, going, here's a joke. Like, he identified it and stepped it out that this was an actual joke that had a setup and a punchline, which not a lot of many comedians actually do anymore. So I think that skill set is kind of eroding away with the way stand-up comedy itself is evolving.
As a viewer,
yes.
there is such a tonal challenge,
yes,
for the roast. And most people fail in the tonality. And on the side of something like the Comedy Central roast, I know the saying that it's mean seems beside the point. But you really do. You can get to that place where this isn't funny.
Yeah.
There is no sense of fun in this roasting anymore. The other way that you can fail is where it's too nice.
Yeah.
It's just too nice. You're just honoring the person as,
right,
opposed to roasting them.
And not tearing into them.
The honor, it seems to me, in the roast is giving the opportunity for the person being roasted to show what a good, healthy sense of humor they have about themselves.
Right.
How much they can laugh at themselves. That's the honor. Is the opportunity to show how much you can laugh at yourself.
But you want to laugh at yourself and your weaknesses amongst the circle of friends. And if it's a bunch of people that just been hired by whatever production company's doing this, then it's either mean-spirited and or you don't know these people.
You don't know these people.
You met them
people?
2 seconds before you went on camera, and then all of a sudden they're saying you're an idiot and you're on drugs, all of that. I would have a hard time laughing at that, going, who the hell are you just to say that?
So here's the you know, the importance then. I think it really is. You need to be able to know where the jokes are.
Yep.
Because if you also don't know where the jokes are, then when they do say certain nice things, because it is also traditional that
you end it in something nice.
Well, you end it, but especially you end it in something nice to show exactly what you're saying, which is that there is a true personal connection.
Right.
That you have with that person.
Yeah.
That clearly, that we get to glimpse that friendship for a moment.
Exactly.
Because that puts everything in that context of kind of allowing us as outsiders to be insiders, not just to the comedy, but to the relationship.
Right.
Which is so interesting. I thought, Shatner acquitted himself most impressively on that show, although he's really become such a go-to fixture at settings like this. Remember the performance that he gave at George Lucas's AFI tribute?
That's right.
Was incredible. But also, he's been a subject of one of the Comedy Central roasts.
So
he knows how awful they are.
Yeah.
And also understands the your mocking, your roasting of the person sitting on the dais needs to be only, or ought to be only, a hair more pointed than your own self-mocking.
Yes. Yeah,
there needs
exactly
to be that element of the self-mocking that's going on too. And if you can combine that, you've achieved the tone.
Yeah, because that's the thing. If you are just mocking them but having it in a status, this is a status transfer. And if you're coming too high status and just trying to tear that other guy apart, you'll come across as like a big dick, and B, no one's going to laugh because it just seems absolutely cruel. I agree. Shatner is almost, he would be the go-to guy now for all the roasts, I would think. Because I don't even know.
Yeah, I mean, couldn't you see that? Oh, actually, yeah. The William Shatner celebrity roast.
Exactly. He can take over the Dean Martin.
He will say yes to any gig. He said yes. He took over, what was it, Iron Chef when it came to this
country.
That's
right.
And
he's doing this reality series.
He's got a couple, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, he was in Vegas with a camera crew talking to all the fans and everything. And I think it was just a continuation of the documentary Trekkies or whatever. He's just doing that as a reality series. It's,
Sarah Winchester, you know, believed that if she kept building onto that house, the Winchester mansion, death could not catch her.
Death would not catch her. The right. ghosts and, of all those who were killed by the
Shatner
Winchester mansion.
Is just building that house. He just keeps building that house. And why he's gonna, he's going psychic. Out with his boots on.
Why not?
Yeah.
Good on him. So
that yeah. was that was interesting. Also, you know, the television season, the fall season.
Oh my gosh, has started. Yeah, what'd you see?
Well, I mean, this is... Is there anything on network television worth watching? I mean, is there anything? I like look at... There are entire networks. Like, ABC is just... It's just... It's a waste. There's tumbleweeds blowing through. They might as well not broadcast anything.
Same
and
money.
The shows that they said they were going to cancel, shows like Castle, for example,
yeah.
they ended up having to keep because they've got nothing that anybody wants to see. It's really incredible. But... Glee had their season premiere, right?
Okay, yeah.
And so. This is something we would have revisited last week, but we had right. a guest. You know, their season premiere audience from year to year dropped a third. It's got a third less of an audience this year than it did last year. And there are many things that go into this. I mean, I think you kind of had said a while ago that the show had probably jumped the shark.
Yeah,
and... releasing that movie,
dear God,
did not
help.
I mean, it's just they oversaturated the brand, which yeah. happens.
And then the Glee audition.
Well, the reality show.
The reality show. What was that called?
At the very least, you're getting a reality show for free, which certainly explained why you weren't going to go see the movie.
Right.
You know, you're getting this for free even during the season when there aren't new episodes of Glee. Right. So. Why would you pay to see in the theaters something? And especially young people who are used to seeing movies for free anyway because they know they're going to be able to online soon right. enough, right? So this oversaturation and probably not understanding the audience base and their habits, you know, certainly affected the audience size. And, of course, the wide-sweeping impact of Your Chill Pack Hollywood.
That's right. How we've trashed that show.
Well, no, didn't trash the show. But, of course, I really... took to task the behavior of Glee creator Ryan Murphy mm-hmm. on the Glee project. I was then chastised by one listener, of course, got many emails that, like I said, I didn't read about being grateful for what I said because I don't like to deal in the positive. I like dealing with the negative comments instead.
Exactly.
But, you know... And this was over the last few weeks, so if you haven't heard those episodes, you know, you
feel free to go back.
Chillpackhollywood.com, CHILLPAK Hollywood.com, and listen to them. But on the UK, when I'm doing my almost weekly cultural correspondence on
Mr. Hollywood, the Handsome
midweek,
Hollywood.
Midweek drive mm-hmm. on sirenonline.co.uk
mm-hmm.
For Southside Broadcasting there.
Nice
they
plug.
Asked about this,
uh-huh.
and you know, it really was very interesting because you know, the person who came to the defense of Ryan Murphy and really chastised the young person for being whiny and being
right,
you know, toughen up and all this, and you know, my feelings that we're becoming such a nation that not only is a bully but likes to side with bullies. And yet this person who demanded that I apologize to Ryan Murphy couldn't even get his name right. Right. And, you know, it is, as I pointed out in the UK, really, in this business, you've got to have a thick enough skin where you don't care about the criticism, but you do care when they get your name wrong.
Right.
That's so, like, really, if Ryan Murphy was going to take issue with what either of us had said, me or the listener, would have taken issue with the listener more because
with Ryan Murphy.
Get his name right.
Yeah.
you know, it really is interesting and does beg this question. Does his appearance, and, you know, what I'd heard from other people who do listen, who do watch that show, The Glee Project, mm-hmm. regularly, is that, yeah, he does not come off well.
Really?
And that's not a surprise. I mean, what would you expect if you saw a reality show behind the scenes of the sitcoms that Chuck Lorre makes?
Right.
Think... Chuck Lorre's audience would stay the same size if people could see how he runs his business. And this is not necessarily even a criticism of him, but, you know, you don't want to see how the sausage gets made.
Yeah, often because it's so caustic.
How about a reality show behind the scenes of Mad Men getting to see how Matthew Weiner runs that office.
Yeah.
Gotta believe, you know, if you saw, you know, the creative people in those stressful situations facing those deadlines week after week, and if you saw these, you might be a little bit
shocked
and turned off.
Right.
To the show that you know you don't want to see behind that curtain.
Yeah.
And that's the downside with the Glee project, I think, is having Ryan Murphy, the creator of it, be such a fundamental piece of it. You're getting to see behind the curtain of the process in a way that you might not want to.
I know. So often a creator will sort of identify with the lead of the show they've created and sort of have that as an extension of himself, particularly when they're writing. And so at any time, you sort of can mistake, like George Costanza.
Exactly.
It was Larry said.
Curb Your Enthusiasm. If Curb Your Enthusiasm had been on at the same time as Seinfeld, would you have been able to, you know, if enjoying Curb Your Enthusiasm, would you still have been able to enjoy Seinfeld
right.
in the same way?
I don't think so. I don't think so, because even going back and watching reruns, like I was planning to do all my entire life, I never watched Seinfeld when it was on the air, because I planned once I was not as busy, I was going to sit down and watch all these Seinfeld episodes. And now, having seen Curb, I'm not really laughing at Seinfeld like I thought I would all these years later.
Wow.
I know. Think of that disappointment.
television. I didn't intend television to be the big theme on this, but
now it is.
So many television-related stories, even when they don't involve the shows themselves. How about Southwest Airlines involved in another controversy?
Oh, yes.
Last time we checked in on them, it was Kevin Smith.
Kevin Smith, which we believed was a marketing ploy to,
and now. And that made news everywhere, which
yes.
is one of the reasons that you think it's a marketing ploy, as opposed to this issue with the former L Word star, Alicia Haley.
Right.
And her partner, Camila Gray, getting kicked off a flight after they kissed each other prior to takeoff.
Right.
And a flight attendant came over.
Said the public display of affection.
We said you can't do that anymore. This is a family airline, was the words that she used. And they were kind of outraged by this. And all the onlookers, as they said it was, you know, a very simple affectionate kiss at the beginning, kind of like you would
do,
especially any of us who are white knuckle travelers,
right?
You know, might do like the, you know, I just want you to know I love you,
right? Right. Before we go,
before this big bird comes down,
we go up in Southwest, exactly.
So apparently the onlookers, you know, are all saying this was not a, you know, it wasn't. They weren't making out in front of. They weren't.
So it was the flight attendant.
And the flight attendant
saw that.
Found that.
So there wasn't a customer complaint.
You think she's closeted?
Gee. Anyway, the point is, there wasn't a customer complaint that she was answering to.
No.
This was her own issue.
This was her own issue. And that's the thing, is that, you know, Southwest Airlines, so they were kicked off. They were removed from the flight because they demanded an apology from the flight attendant, and so she kicked them off. And
not quite the apology they were looking for.
And the airline has yet to apologize or to condemn or criticize the flight attendant in any way. And Southwest actually has a really good track record in terms of, I think they're the official airline of GLAD.
Oh, really?
And they have a really good track record, but it really is interesting, you know, when it comes down to, you know, corporate policy versus just personal interaction.
Right.
And you want corporations to set policy that make them seem inclusive, but really, when it comes down to being inclusive, it just does come down to how we treat each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I'm a little bit of an old fogey, you know.
You?
I think there is a behavior that's inappropriate. I don't, you know, I don't think people should be, you know,
totally make it out,
totally make it out
like
on a flight or whatever. And at the same time, though, you know, it is so miserable, the experience of flying, and
particularly Southwest,
and any genuine emotion, especially love, there isn't kind of enough of.
Yep.
And quite frankly, I always feel safer when there's actually people on a flight expressing love. I feel like, oh, you know, like, that's why I love when there's children on a flight.
Right.
I just feel like, okay, creator of the universe.
Even,
you know,
right.
You can't bring this one down. There's love here.
Except when that kid cries for the whole flight. Then, you know.
And so, you know, it's
yeah, it's shocking, actually, because you would think that, this would get more press, but again...
It hasn't.
And
that's the real reason I brought it up. It hasn't gotten any press at all, and that's what's rather extraordinary and disappointing, because, again, this is the kind of conversation that I feel sometimes is more meaningful than, you know, a big national policy debate over gay marriage.
Right.
It's more important in that... You know,
it's
what
a day-to-day
we want to work
function.
Towards is, yeah, the day-to-day human interaction,
yeah.
And how do we treat our fellow man, and how do we encourage relationship? How do we encourage love? How do we encourage healthy affection and healthy displays of affection? How do we do all these things to build a healthier community? And it does start from how we interact with each other. It cannot start from the big,
right,
over umbrella policy
government.
And I do... fundamentally respect that there are people who have real personal disagreements with the idea of same-sex marriage. I'm not going to paint anyone who's against same-sex marriage as a bigot or
right.
as being prejudiced, because I haven't listened to them. I haven't heard their feelings. I haven't heard their side of it. At the same time, I do want to respect everybody's ability to express their own personal feelings, because
right.
if they don't, how can we ever talk about these things? And that brings us back to, if we don't get to hear about this news story, how can we talk about it?
Which then brings it back to Kevin Smith and the proof that that was a marketing ploy, because that got an inordinate amount of press. And this is almost not the same issue, but clearly by...
But it is so similar in terms of getting kicked off a flight, the same airline.
Same airline and everything. And yet here this one story squashed, and the Kevin Smith one just... prove the point that they had a separate counter for overweight passengers. Which, how do you advertise that without some sort of built-in controversy with some celebrity who's kicked off a plane for being overweight?
When we both left last week's show, said goodbye, we were both talking about the fact that we had missed the season premiere of Pan Am.
No,
we were
yes.
both looking forward to it.
Right.
Have you caught up to this?
I have not caught up to this yet. Have you?
10 minutes in to the show, oh, I actually God. Tweeted, "Dear God, I want to take my own life." I mean, to say that it's horrible is to you know, with all due respects to all things that are horrible, I owe an apology to everything that's horrible to say that Pan Am is horrible. I mean, this you might as well just stop making TV if this is what it's going to be.
So I shouldn't give
Mad
you my...
Mad Men meets the Love Boat.
I shouldn't give you my Pan Am luggage tag that
well,
I got with my New
but,
York Times?
But, you know, instead of just bashing on a horrible show that's already dangling by a thread, you know, in the ratings. And so sad because, you know, no bigger fan of Christina Ricci than
you.
Than me.
Yep.
And she's in this and she's got a gig, and they could have cast anybody because they're certainly not letting her do anything. And it's so sad, and it kind of underscores for me something, which is that, you know, America doesn't actually really... They like Christina Ricci if liking Christina Ricci doesn't mean actually seeing something she does that's interesting. Because her stuff... hasn't been successful.
Right.
And she's so unique and so idiosyncratic and dangerous. And,
yeah.
And here she's scrubbed so clean. But why I bring up Pan Am is here's the reason that this show was going to fail. No matter what. No matter even if it was good. We do not... want to be reminded of a time when flying was fun
and awesome, and you got a
and
bigger
glamorous,
meal
and exciting
and, you
and
dressed
an adventure
up. Exactly.
Oh, adventures in the sky,
right?
We don't want to be reminded of, you know, if we wanted to be reminded of how good things used to be, we'd spend time talking to our parents.
Exactly. I know. I see. I didn't watch it, but I saw the clips where they're being served giant meals with flowers, and you just go, why am I now in a tin fuselage of a rolling mental institution that, you know, is shuffling me like cattle around the sky?
And the only explanation is the people who developed this show and the people who are, you know, behind the networks and everything, of course, who, by the way, have not flown commercial
ever
in yeah, maybe ever. And if they do, you know, if they're going to rough it, they're going to rough it in Richard Branson's First Class on Virgin Atlantic.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So they have no idea. They clearly can't. But, I mean, that was a no-brainer. Where was the marketing behind that?
Well, and I think that's why they were pushing that whole...
And a dead airline.
Well, they had to do a dead airline because you can't do a fake airline because, and you can't do...
There was an attempt. Remember, wasn't there a show recently set on Virgin America? There was a Swedish show, a flight attendant show set on Virgin America.
Wow, I missed that.
That did not do particularly well.
Wow. Yeah. Holy smokes. Well, you know what I've been watching? I caught my second episode of Charlie's Angels.
And second and last, apparently, from what I'm reading. Right,
yeah. You know, I the voice of Charlie for the first episode sounded so awful until you read the credits and realized...
Robert Wagner.
Robert.
Did you talk about this last week? I can't remember if we did.
So, anyway, it didn't get better any on the second episode. Actually, it did get better. The second episode was better, but that's just to say the car ran all the way to the end of the track. And that was it.
I actually posted the next to last episode of the season of Breaking Bad was last night, directed by Vince Gilligan. A really good episode. And although I actually will see where it goes next week, but I do have some criticisms. Potentially.
What?
We have to see where it pays off.
Oh.
But the problem with this show being so damn good,
yes,
is it's kind of ruined me for other shows.
Exactly.
And so I'm left going, next week's the season finale.
What
do I watch now?
Yeah, exactly.
Not to pass the time, but what do I put any investment in? And the good news about the era in which we live, I mean, one of the great things about this is, you know, I just finished watching Smiley's People, the sequel series to Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, with Alec Guinness and Patrick Stewart. And by the way, I've heard that the Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy movie with Gary Oldman is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that... they do all three books in the series.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm going back, and all these shows are available, and so I'm going. I just started season one of the Helen Mirren original Prime Suspect.
Prime Suspect. Series. Wow. So good.
I'm starting the BBC series Second Sight with Clive Owen.
Clive Owen.
And
your man crush.
And of course, just started. BBC's Torchwood.
Oh, you did? Just
and
started?
All these things are available, and so there really is, you know, there's no shortage.
There's no shortage.
In that sense.
Right. I also recommend Luther. You might...
You've mentioned that on the show. That was in your top 10 shows.
My top 10 shows, and the new a new series of that just started up.
Hey, I'm coming towards the end of, or I'm in volume 2 of Harvey Birdman.
Look at you go.
I do pay attention to your recommendations.
Fantastic.
So there is always plenty of things.
I should listen to your recommendations one of these days.
Yeah, more. Now,
yeah.
Your old friend Chris Carter's coming back to television.
Is he now?
Yeah. And I love how it was reported in Deadline Hollywood. He's writing, directing, and of course will be executive producer, but doing a pilot for a show called Unique, and it's a thriller focusing on a female character with a supernatural element.
Fantastic.
Coming back to television with Unique. I also love in Deadline Hollywood, you know, that they said, and he'll have the upcoming thriller Fence Walker. That's his film that he made in 2008.
That's the one that's not being...
Still nothing. There's still nothing. And but this was how they ended the blurb in Deadline Hollywood, which has been picked up everywhere. There is now talk... about a potential third X-Files movie. And what's so funny is I heard about this whole thing, this whole story from listeners to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, because, of course, really, we're the ones talking about a potential third X-Files. That's the talk. And I do love how they wrote that in Deadline Hollywood. There is now talk of a third X-Files movie.
Right.
There's no news.
There's no news.
There's just talk.
There's talk, mainly from us.
Yeah.
Relayed.
And from everyone. Or Jillian does one interview and she says, hey, we'd be game for it.
Right.
But there's no news. And quite frankly, if he's coming back to TV with the series...
He's got no time for...
Yeah.
How is he even going to write? Wow.
So...
This is going to be fascinating. When is that...
I don't know. I would think maybe next year, right?
Not a mid-season replacement.
Wouldn't be right now. They'd be shooting for...
Yeah, a mid-season replacement if it was to happen in January.
Maybe. That's possible, I guess.
Could happen.
You know, I found this report very, very interesting. Boy, so much about TV. This is really interesting.
This is our TV show.
In these divisive political times, political climate, it's very popular, of course, to bash people on the left.
People
want to take back the country from the people on the right.
Yes.
And of course, one of the ways they want to do it is, you know, something's got to be done about Fox News, right? The conservative agenda of Fox News. And of course, there's a conservative agenda there. Though, as we've talked about on the show, there is certainly as much of a possibility that this was business rather than this was political in nature.
Right.
Rupert Murdoch is a super smart businessman, and he found a niche.
Mm-hmm.
And just like he found a niche in tabloid journalism.
That's right.
And as we've always pointed out, you know, keep in mind that the man behind the most conservative news network is also the man behind the most liberal entertainment network.
Mm, right.
And I was again reminded of this when GLAAD released their annual report on inclusivity of the LGBT community and issues on television.
Behind the scenes and on screen.
And Fox, far and away, the most inclusive network in terms of LGBT characters on television.
How about that?
It's overall on television, it's somewhere along the lines of 2.5% of the characters on TV are LGBT characters, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered characters. And on Fox, it's more than triple the average.
Wow.
It's inclusive on Fox. So here you have a news network where it seems for many on the left that they are anti-gay.
Right.
Because, you know, opposed to, you know, bringing people on who express their opposition to same-sex marriage,
right,
on such a regular basis. And then here's a network that's owned by the very same people, and they advocate inclusivity.
Go figure. Fascinating. And just goes to show that it's, you know, I'm not sure how much Rupert Murdoch, like I have always said, the one meeting that I heard he attended for Fox Television was, yeah, so here's our budget. It's going to be, you know, this year is going to be $500 million of cost to make our season. And he goes, can we make that $400? And he goes, yeah, yes, sir, we can. And they just, and then suddenly throughout all the productions, you're cut, everybody's cut like $100 million out. Wow. And that's all he cared about. It wasn't like, oh, what's the shows? Oh, what do we have something good in the action department? He could not give a crap. Just can we cut $100 million out of that budget?
And as I've said before, you know, in terms of the news networks, no one puts on a production like Fox News.
Right. A lot of those same people probably doing the promos for Fox, then get over.
Well,
to Fox
I mean, it just it's the best. It's the best of the carnivals.
Right.
Right. They're all three ring circuses or whatever.
Dog and pony shows.
And it's the best at the game.
Wow. I should watch it.
Now, so much to talk about with film because we're also getting into the most exciting time of the year is film.
Award seasons.
Well, when studios suddenly think, oh, this is when we have to release all our good films all at once.
Right.
Although, as I've been saying, it's been a very strong year with good films coming out all the time.
Yeah.
Still, that might be a product of simply actually people making good films as opposed to a new marketing or distribution idea.
Bland.
Right? It just could be blind luck.
Yeah.
Whereas you still do know that anyone who has eyes on marketing an award film, they're pushing them now. It's coming out now.
Right.
And they're backed up and ready to go.
We got to do it.
And still, though, this is a perfect segue from television into film because I, as we spend so much time talking about the way distribution is changing and the way that the studios are almost at battle with the theater chains now.
Yeah,
while at the same time they're at battle with Netflix and they're, you know, all these are partnered together because it's all part of the economic model, and yet the different partners in the economic model are at odds more than ever.
Right.
Fascinating time. But in Palm Springs, there is a theater lawsuit going on. Have you seen this?
No.
Between an independent theater and the Cinemark theater chain.
Okay.
Because there is a big multiplex, an independent multiplex, called the Palm Door,
I love
named
that.
For the top prize at Cannes.
Yeah.
It has a very nice French cafe in the theater.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a great, great place to see the film. Everything about this theater makes me want to go there.
Is it just one screen?
No, it's multiplex. And they play the type of smart house. Let's not say art house,
right?
But smart house films, independent films, foreign language films, documentaries.
Things you read about but never know where the hell to see
them. And even studio films that are aimed at a more adult audience. Something like The Debt, for example.
Okay.
And they play them. And yes, this is apparently the first place where you would be able to see these films.
Yes.
Without driving from Palm Springs all the way into Los Angeles, which is a long drive, especially for the age of an audience that wants to go see these things.
Right.
And
a lot of the film community has a second house down there.
Yeah. So they are suing Cinemark because, according to the lawsuit, what Cinemark has been doing, and this is not news to me, this happens a great deal, it's kind of like what Jay Leno used to do as his booking practice when he took over The Tonight Show. They would go to agents and say, if you let your people be on Letterman before they're on us, you'll never get your big stars or your big movies pushed on The Tonight Show ever again.
Ah.
Well, guess what Cinemark is doing? If you put these movies in there, we won't handle your big movies in our chain.
Ah.
Never mind that these are probably movies that they don't want in the first place.
Right.
So the owner, the one of the principal co-owners of the theater, this independent theater, Palme d'Or, kind of described it to like Cinemark being Starbucks, and we're an independently owned
coffee chain,
and what they're preventing us from getting are the beans. We're using beans that they don't want, but they come from the same suppliers. So right. They're telling the suppliers, look, don't give them beans.
Just to squeeze them out and run them out of business.
Don't let them show movies. Because whatever they're showing, they're in competition with us, even though they're not movies we want.
So that's not competition, other than you're taking people who will go to a movie
right.
that night.
They would just go to a movie. Right. It's like I always say with marketing, people are going to go to movies.
Yeah.
If all you offer them is crap, they're going to take the crap that's marketed or packaged the most attractively.
Right, because you go to the multiplex, you just look up and go, what's playing? Because you plan to go out all night. It's not like you suddenly got out of the house because Tom Cruise is in a movie.
So why do I bring this up, Dean Haglund, as a transition from television to film?
Well, I can only think that it has something to do particularly with your own personal background.
No.
Oh.
It has to do with, again, what am I going to do when Breaking Bad is off the air?
You're going to drive to Palm Springs.
Theater is owned by, and the spokesperson for this theater is one Bryan Cranston.
Look at that!
Emmy Award-winning star of Breaking Bad.
How about
that?
Who has
been in so many movies that I've seen lately, from Drive to Contagion to, oh my goodness, oh, The Lincoln Lawyer.
Was he in that?
Matthew McConaughey, yeah.
That's something.
So, you know, he's really getting wonderful supporting character roles.
Fantastic.
But he is a true cinema lover.
Yeah.
And he put his money into this theater and wanted it to be a great cinema-going experience. And that's why this is starting to get press.
Because it's Bryan Cranston.
Because it's Bryan Cranston, and he is using his name to go and get this story into papers.
Well, and that'd be great, because then if that changes the way studios do business, that can, that whole Show West gangster thing.
Because what chance does an independent theater have in a lawsuit against big corporations, especially big corporations that are then in bed with big corporations?
Right. They have unlimited pockets. So.
Only shaming them. Only shaming them.
Right.
And again, there's one thing that Hollywood doesn't like, and that is when they are, and when I say Hollywood, I mean the corporations behind it.
Right.
When it seems like they don't care about the creative personalities.
Right.
When it seems like they don't care about them, that's the one thing that kind of holds them in check.
Right.
That it's why Sean Connery, once upon a time, was famous when he was at the height of his career, celebrity. He had at least one, if not two, lawsuits going against every studio.
Oh, you're kidding.
At the time. And they asked him, you know, why are you so litigious? Do you think you're going to win any of these? And he said, no. Here's the thing, though. I'm Sean Connery. They're going to hire me even if I've got lawsuits pending against them. So if someone in my unique position does not try to hold them accountable, Who can possibly hold them accountable? One of those rare stories that actually makes you like Sean Connery.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. So funny. Wow.
Anyway, so I thought that was really quite... And this is another reason to just like Bryan Cranston.
Absolutely.
And everything we've heard about him, I met him once, but we have so many friends, you know, from Gary Anthony Williams, who's been on the show, from Dan Butler, who's been on the show, all of whom just, you know, rave... Vince, of
course. Fitzgerald, of course,
just rave about not only this man as a talent, but as truly one of the good guys.
Absolutely. I actually saw him at a trade show when I was
at the Chilpac
trade show where
the Green Expo
where he came by. He was building a house that was going to be totally green and have zero environmental impact, and that was really cool, and we had a nice chat actually. So good on you, Bryan. May you fight the fight.
Okay, there's a big story I want to bring up at the very end, but let's talk film for about 10 minutes, okay? There is a... We made a documentary.
We did,
Is equal parts comedy, consciousness, and conspiracy.
Called?
The Truth is Out There.
Yes.
You know...
Available?
Your Chilpac Hollywood Hour, by the way, is brought to you by... Your Chilpac Hollywood Hour. Truly, because we have a 4th anniversary bonus show.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see how many listeners we have on Jackalope Radio
alone? It's crazy.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So here's what I would ask our listeners on Jackalope Radio and wherever you may find this show. Please write us at chilpachollywood@yahoo.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood@yahoo.com, and request the bonus 4th anniversary show with never-before-heard material.
Hilarious.
This show will never be available any other way.
Right.
Other than through us as a $1.29
so
purchase.
Cheap.
And why we want you to do this is because, quite frankly, it's a great show. And because it will enable us to continue forever to bring you your Chilpac Hollywood Hour for free on a weekly basis.
It's easy.
So please help us out by getting the 4th anniversary show.
Right.
Your Chilpac Hollywood Hour is also brought to you each week by The Truth is Out There.
Our documentary.
An epic documentary about comedy, consciousness, and conspiracy starring Dean Hagelin from The X-Files.
I'm
and
in that thing.
Gunman. People can find out all about it, can see the trailer, can order it, can find out where it's screening. You're on the way to Buffalo, New York, and Springville, New York, this week
show
The Truth is Out There and your artwork.
Absolutely. If you're in Buffalo on the 7th, we'll be screening at the Albright Knox Museum, and
on the
8th at the Springville Art Center.
And all those details are available at the website truth-is-out-there.com. Truth is out there with dashes in between .com.
Yes.
So find out all about the film, our upcoming appearances in
come to
Salem,
my art
Oregon,
show.
San Leandro, California, Melbourne, Australia, all this stuff. Find out about it. Here's why I also bring this up the weekly shameless plug.
Now here's a shameful plug.
The conspiracy theories that I find distasteful are ones... It's kind of expanded and altered a little bit since the film. We talk about this a little bit in the film, right? The ones that troubled me.
Yes.
The ones that I find distasteful are ones that argue that we are less than an amazing species. That say that, that argue that fantastic human achievements, in fact, did not happen. And not only did they not happen, were not possible.
Were alien interventions?
I speak, for example, of things like, you know, the moon landing didn't happen.
All right.
You know, these things that, you know, you can try to prove it all day long if you want. And at some point, though, you are telling a story. And what is the value of your story? And if the value of your story is to rob human beings of things to aspire to.
Right.
I would beseech you to ask how important that is.
Right.
G. Edward Griffin said something that was fantastic when we were interviewing him for The Truth is Out There. And this is not in the film, but this was a really interesting thing. And he talked about how it became very popular to sort of discredit the founding fathers.
Right.
You know, yes, these were flawed men because they were men. In the process of making the focus be on their flaws rather than on their achievements, you have to a degree eliminated figures for which young people can aspire to.
Right.
And that's the importance of storytelling, giving us something to aspire to. The other thing that it does, of course, if you argue through your story, through your theory, that we are something less than a powerful, remarkable species, you're also letting us off the hook for responsibility.
Yeah, that's right.
If we don't have power, we also then don't have responsibility.
So therefore, we are free to...
Why do I bring this up?
Why?
Well, because one of these theories that has always driven me nuts, also because it's the worst kind of scholarship. It's lazy scholarship. But Shakespeare didn't write his plays.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this is so boring. And one of the reasons this is so boring is that... if you're arguing that Shakespeare wasn't a genius behind it, you're also at the same time elevating yourself above Shakespeare.
Ah.
You know, not only was he not a genius, but I'm the genius that figured out that he didn't write that.
Right.
And so it's so funny. And never has this kind of distasteful quality been more apparent than when the genius behind this theory is the guy who made Godzilla starring Matthew Broderick.
Ah.
Roland Emmerich has a movie called Anonymous.
Anonymous.
A conspiracy theory film about Shakespeare.
Right.
He was a fraud.
Right.
Let's talk about fraud.
Ah, you got to tear into Roland?
For a minute.
Awesome.
Let's talk about fraud, Mr.
Godzilla.
Didn't he make also 10 million B.C.?
Oh, 10,000 B.C.
10,000 B.C.?
Yeah.
Where...
sexy models ran the roam the earth
and with mastodons.
Mastodons pulling the bricks up the pyramid.
Also,
all scholarly, very scholarly.
Did he do 2012? Also, I think he did.
Oh, did he? Yes.
Yeah.
With
the conspiracy theory that only John Cusack will survive the end of days.
That's right. And when you take off from LAX,
that might be true.
Yeah,
quite frankly, because if anyone's going to replenish the gene pool, it ought to be
John Cusack. But here's the other thing: when you take off from LAX, always fly through downtown LA, because that's where you want to get your plane. Even though you're flying over the ocean and the earthquake is coming, turn the plane around and go back through downtown and just dodge buildings as they collapse around you. That I always loved in that movie.
You know, and I just feel like also this guy who, you know, look, I've liked some of I've liked a third and a half of movies that
he's done.
Roland Emmerich has made. I liked the first third of Stargate. I liked
kind
of half of Independence Day.
Sure.
And, you know, but let's face it, this man is not someone whose body of work argues for, let's say, literacy. In any way. In fact, Dean Devlin, you know, even talks about their partnership began because he was an actor on Universal Soldier. And
Roland was?
Dean Devlin.
Oh, Dean Devlin.
He's an actor. Yeah, studied with Roy London. And he was an actor on Universal Soldier, and he was brought in, and they hit it off. And Roland Emmerich and Dean Devlin would talk about the fact that the script was terrible. And Roland Emmerich would basically say, look, I don't understand English. I'm not really interested in the written word. Fix it if you can. And so Dean Devlin started rewriting this movie that he was in, and then that's how they became writing and producing partners together.
Look at that.
Who
better to do a Shakespeare?
The guy behind, Godzilla, you know, basically sending the message of, you don't need to really bother reading Shakespeare's plays.
To know that he didn't write them.
But don't even bother. Don't even bother.
Right.
You know, and what you need to know, you can learn from movies, and not just movies, but my movies. Wow. That's just the... And see, here's what I think. If scholars who had argued that Shakespeare didn't write his plays knew that someday this theory was not only going to be championed, but co-opted by Roland Emmerich, you think that would have given them pause in coming up with the theory in the first place?
They would have stopped and going, could go...
It's like all the scholars who, you know, created the basis... for what would become the story of the Da Vinci Code.
Right.
And who then went and sued Dan Brown saying this is based on our...
theories.
Our scholarship.
And you perverted it.
Yeah, and you... Right. And it's like now the people who came up with those theories about Shakespeare. And there was a time when it was really popular, especially...
Francis Bacon wrote it. Who else?
And especially in terms of graduate students working on their dissertations to come up with some sort of analysis on this. But, of course, this was literary analysis.
Well,
this wasn't a conspiracy theory thriller by Roland Emmerich, the creative genius behind the Matthew Broderick version of Godzilla.
Oh, right. Which, that movie, by the way, they couldn't replicate the Godzilla scream from the 1950s, so they just lifted it.
I know that?
There was not even like a sound crew that could develop could replicate what the Toho Studios, was it Toho or Toyo?
I don't know.
Toho, I think it was, wasn't it? Those guys. Okay, well, Anonymous, off my list.
Now, there have been so many good movies.
Yes, what'd you see?
Some of which I wanted. You know, I saw that Drive.
I want to see that Drive.
Ryan Gosling. It's so interesting, and it's been bizarre because it's failed, and it's failed because young men didn't go to see it. They expected young men to be the audience. Young men haven't gone to see it at all.
Huh.
I'm not sure Ryan Gosling has an audience base of young men. I don't know if he does.
No.
And because of the violent nature of it, young women would go to it in smaller numbers than they would, let's say, a different film that he would be in. It's very interesting of him and very brave of anyone his stature to play a sociopath in a film as a lead.
Right.
But it's also a very interesting kind of... They draw obvious references not only to 80s films like Wild at Heart or Blue Velvet.
Right.
You know, I thought the apt analogy of it being like a linear David Lynch film.
Yeah, you're right. You said that.
But also it has some very real references, overt references to Taxi Driver, which is another kind of thriller about a sociopath.
Yeah.
But kind of the difference is that when Taxi Driver came out, the world within the film treated the sociopath as a hero.
Right.
We, the audience, would be troubled by the sociopath.
Right.
The difference, interestingly, you know, 30 years later, is that the audience champions now the sociopath. We treat the sociopath in the story as the hero. And it's a little disturbing, but also what makes kind of the film worthwhile and scintillating.
Gotta see it.
So that was great. Saw the new Pedro Almodovar film, The Skin I Live In.
Oh, yes. That's the skin grafting.
It's a science fiction film. It's a thriller. It's a romantic film. It's a mystery. Here's the thing about Pedro Almodovar when his films are good and when his films aren't good. The one thing is you never can know where they're heading.
Right.
You can never predict them. You can never outthink them. And that's always exciting.
Always exciting. There's no...
You don't know. It's, and in fact, kind of an amazing combination, which is if I didn't tell you who made the film, if you didn't see the opening credits and you sat down to start to watch it, you would know within minutes that it's an Almodovar film. It is recognizable as this man's work without ever being predictable.
Isn't that something?
That's an incredible combination.
Well, it should be like any artwork. You have your technique that is as distinct as a fingerprint that is left on the project that you work on, regardless of how you try to switch it up or
and
whatever.
And yet in film, that seems so difficult. But it is kind of like painting.
Yeah.
It does remind me of that.
Yeah, yeah.
That, oh, I know who this painter is, and yet I'm blown away because this is...
different every time.
So unexpected.
Right. How unique is that?
So it was fantastic. I see it at the Directors Guild with a largely older crowd. It's packed, though. What I love is a third of the audience hates it. Wants to walk out. A third of it is giving it a huge ovation, and then a third of it is going, well, that was a great comedy, but I'm not sure I'm supposed to be laughing.
I should have laughed at some of that. Oh, that's awesome.
And it stars Antonio Banderas, and it's so great to see him in something that's kind of worthy of him.
Right.
Because he's kind of grown into an interesting man.
Yeah.
And it's the first time he's worked with Almodovar since Almodovar made him a star some 20 years ago.
Right.
So it's really cool.
Oh, good.
I won't talk about the films that aren't so good, although I did see Contagion, right?
Yes,
which is not a bad movie.
Right.
But, you know, first of all, Steven Soderbergh, how dare you side with the powerful and the rich politically and make your only true bad guy in the film be the one independent who's saying, you know what, maybe we shouldn't trust pharmaceuticals and we shouldn't trust insurance companies. The only one with a historic viewpoint of what these companies have done to us. I'm not saying that you shouldn't maybe paint that person in grays like you do everyone else, but to make them the only bad guy.
Solid
be the
black.
One person, the one person who's arguing, you know what, maybe we shouldn't be taking these vaccines that people...
Handy to
Boy,
us.
Boy, how is the film not an ad for the CDC and for pharmaceuticals and this? But the other thing, just from a film standpoint, you know, you're going to make a thriller about an illness. It sort of is tough when, you know, you can build all the momentum in the world, but when you keep cutting to people whose whole thing is, oh, I'm so tired, I have such a headache. It kind of sucks the energy out of a thriller.
The big moaning disease.
And, of course, in any kind of disaster thing, the second half of the film is about finding a cure for it, and that's nowhere near as interesting as setting up the disaster.
The disaster and how it's spreading, and oh my gosh. Oh, well. Up my list.
But I saw an independent film, a good independent film, called Like Crazy. I bring this up because whenever we see actors who are... We're really good at finding... I'm going to pat us on the back.
Yes.
But we're really good at finding young actors who are going to be really actors to watch for a career, for, you know, for a lifetime, who are going to become major, major artists of their generation. And I go back to when, for example, we were developing Illumination, and we said, having seen Joseph Gordon-Levitt in Brick, and saying, this is our guy. And then what we faced within, you know, the Hollywood structure was, yeah, but he's not box office, he can't open a movie, he can't. And now suddenly
there's nobody movies
50-50 and 500 Days of Summer, and we were right.
And where am I going on Monday, October 10th? To see his collaboration project over at the Orpheum.
Wow.
Yeah, he's got this new hit record or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And he's doing it live at the Orpheum on October 10th.
Well, so then after Joseph Gordon-Levitt, I turned my attention to my friend Tom Hardy, who had played Shinzon in the Star Trek movie, but wasn't really getting any decent roles.
And again,
people are telling me, well, no, he's not, you know, he's not a name. He can't open, you know, he can't do this. He can't, you know, are you sure? Are you sure? Aren't there anybody else that's right for it? I go, this guy's a great actor. This is going to be a big deal. You know, an Olivier Award on stage.
Yep.
The defining Wuthering Heights on BBC.
Yep.
Scene-stealing turns in everything from Layer Cake to
Inception.
Inception later, and now suddenly he's a go-to movie star.
There you go.
22-year-old Anton Yelchin. We've talked about before.
Yes.
So good in Jodie Foster's The Beaver.
Yes.
This guy in this movie, Like Crazy, gives a performance of such sensitivity and such range,
really?
And such depth. By the time I walked out, I had no idea how old this kid was, and I had to go look up that he's 22, because he plays an age range in it, and he just energetically embodies so much. Felicity Jones is in it, and she's really wonderful as well, but just seeing this film as a statement that a major young actor has emerged.
But this guy's been on everybody's radar for years now. He's played a young David Duchovny in House of D. David Duchovny
is
directed.
He really?
Yep.
Yeah.
So he's been known for a while.
Okay, so this leaves me 3 minutes to unravel the mysteries of the universe. Did you see that CERN... The laboratory in Europe, Switzerland,
yeah.
Sent neutrinos.
Yes.
Now, years ago, we did our most listened to show ever about 2012, about the end of the Mayan calendar. And one of the things we suggested was, you know, what does it mean, the end of a calendar? One of the things it just might mean is literally that, the end of calendars.
Right.
It might mean that we start to measure time in a different way.
Exactly.
And we pointed to the work being done by CERN and the Hadron Super Collider as ultimately revealing something that might force us to reexamine how time is measured.
Exactly.
Flash forward to week before last, they send neutrinos to a measuring station in the Gran Sasso measuring station in Italy. They sent these from Geneva, and they arrived 60 nanoseconds faster than the speed of light.
Right, which they thought was a human error.
Now this doesn't sound like a lot, but you're talking about only 420 miles. And it arrived 60 nanoseconds faster than the speed of light. At first, they thought, well, okay, well, this has to be an error. And they recheck and they recheck. They recheck 3 years of data. And no, this is right. And what comes out is this has happened before in other places.
Oh.
But people hadn't been keeping the data enough to be able to support that this is
indeed
real.
I think.
And what's fascinating, of course, about this is that now scientists are going to really try to recreate this.
Right.
And it's so surprising because this violates every
Einstein's
law of
speed
of
limit.
Understanding.
Yeah.
And I love that. And it reminds me of what Bill Tiller says in our film, The Truth Is Out There, about how science doesn't look to understand nature. What they look for is consistency to prove a theory about nature that's based on space and time.
Right, that's already in the orthodoxy, as it were.
And, you know, and now there's this whole thing, again, we need to come up with a new theory that encompasses all of it.
Right.
Right? As opposed to deepening our understanding. It doesn't have to be throw out the theory. It doesn't have to be this or this new theory. It can be this and this new theory,
yeah,
because we're deepening our understanding that within certain constructs, yes,
this
our
happens.
Understanding is true. But when you break through to another level, other things become possible. And this is how we operate our lives.
Totally, all the time. And you don't get rid of the old.
And here's what I would say to the question of was Einstein wrong? How about this for a mind-boggling one?
Okay, here we go.
Not only might Einstein have been right, but neutrinos traveling at faster than the speed of light may not even have been possible back then because we weren't observing them.
Mm, that's right.
How does our observation affect it? And this is what Bill Tiller, this is what Noetics is about. This is about our ability to become conscious co-creators of what we're experiencing.
Of our own reality.
We might be able to inspire potentiality around us through our observation, through the questions we ask, and through what we expect to see.
Right.
We have had this in our zeitgeist for so long that there has got to be a way, if not to go faster than the speed of light, to transcend that speed of light.
That's
like David Sirita talks about in The Truth Is Out There, it's not about necessarily going faster than light, it's about dropping maybe out of this universe.
Right.
Out of this dimension.
Three-dimensional reality where that light is the speed limit.
Right.
Interesting.
And come back in somewhere else.
Absolutely.
And so that's what's fascinating. It's not a surprise to me at all that we discovered this. In fact, we were going to discover it because we were looking for it.
Right.
And we were and this brings me, you know, to mind, of course, 9/11 and the question of, you know, did the writers of The Lone Gunman know what was going to happen? Yes. They knew what was going to happen on 9/11. The same way that Tom Clancy knew, the same way that Lee McCloskey, the painter who drew the falling of the towers in 1986 on 9/11,
right,
knew, the same way so many of us knew, the same way a woman who I was helping with her dream work knew when the night before 9/11 she dreamt about walking through the rubble of the World Trade Center,
wow,
and finding an apple that had been burnt away. Half of it had been burned away. We knew in that sense that we all have of what's going on in our collective, of what is possible, of what is going on, of what is manifesting. And it's also, again, brings me back to the importance of, you know, this Shakespeare theory and all of these theories.
Right.
Of I caution against stories that tell you
you are less than
you, you are less than that, you have less than the ability to co-create what is going on around you. There is much we cannot change. There is much we can co-create going on around us, and this glimpse of these nanoseconds, you know, these 60 nanoseconds
of neutrinos
offer what. And again, how extraordinary are we, no matter what the cause of it is, no matter what we may find from here, how extraordinary are we that we can measure this, that we have the ability to measure.
I know.
That.
Think of that.
Is so inspiring.
I'm inspired.
We may be so stupid as to think that a network show about how much fun airline travel used to be. Hey, won't it be fun to have your noses rubbed in it every week about how things used to be fun?
Right.
And at the same time, we can measure how fast neutrinos fly.
That's amazing.
That's
pretty
cool.
Light.
It's pretty cool.
Well, we've co-created another Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, haven't we?
We have. I'm your co-creator in podcasting.
I'm your co-creator, Dean Haglund. Follow us on Twitter.
You are
Dean Haglund.
I'm Phil Lernis.
And
you can become a liker of the show on Facebook, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. Have fun in
New York.
Yeah, in upstate New York. Yes. Buffalo.
Buffalo. Springville. See you Friday in Buffalo.
And if you can make it there, you can make it. No, not
Buffalo.
No.
I'm shuffling off to Buffalo.
Very good.
There you go.
We'll see you next week.
Excellent.